he wanted. It was the Canon Cat, and it was a total flop, Atkinson said. Nobody wanted it. When Steve turned the Mac into a compact version of the Lisa, it made it into a computing platform instead of a consumer electronic device. Texaco Towers. A few days after Raskin left, Jobs appeared at the cubicle of Andy Hertzfeld, a young engineer on the Apple II team, who had a cherubic face and impish demeanor similar to his pal Burl Smith's. Hertzfeld recalled that most of his colleagues were afraid of Jobs because of his spontaneous temper tantrums and his proclivity to tell everyone exactly what he thought, which often wasn't very favorable. But Hertzfeld was excited by him. "Are you any good?" Jobs asked the moment he walked in. "We only want really good people working on the Mac, and I'm not sure you're good enough." Hertzfeld knew how to answer. "I told him that, yes, I thought I was pretty good." Jobs left, and Hertzfeld went back to his work. Later that afternoon, he looked up to see Jobs peering over the wall of his cubicle. "I've got good news for you," he said. "You're working on the Mac team now. Come with me." Hertzfeld replied that he needed a couple more days to finish the Apple II product he was in the middle of. "What's more important than working on the Macintosh?" Jobs demanded. Hertzfeld explained that he needed to get his Apple II DOS program in good enough shape to hand it over to someone. "You're just wasting your time with that," Jobs replied. "Who cares about the Apple II? The Apple II will be dead in a few years. The Macintosh is the future of Apple, and you're going to start on it now." With that, Jobs yanked out the power cord to Hertzfeld's Apple II, causing the code he was working on to vanish. "Come with me," Jobs said. "I'm going to take you to your new desk." Jobs drove Hertzfeld, computer and all, in his silver Mercedes to the Macintosh offices. "Here's your new desk," he said, plopping him in a space next to Burl Smith. "Welcome to the Mac team." The desk had been Raskin's. In fact, Raskin had left so hastily that some of the drawers were still filled with his flotsam and jetsam, including model airplanes. Jobs' primary test for recruiting people in the spring of 1981 to be part of his merry band of pirates was making sure they had a passion for the product. He would sometimes bring candidates into a room where a prototype of the Mac was covered by a cloth, dramatically unveil it, and watch. If their eyes lit up, if they went right for the mouse and started pointing and clicking, Steve would smile and hire them, recalled Andrea Cunningham. He wanted them to say, "Wow." Bruce Horn was one of the programmers at Xerox PARC. When some of his friends, such as Larry Tesler, decided to join the Macintosh group, Horn considered going there as well. But he got a good offer and a $15,000 signing bonus to join another company. Jobs called him on a Friday night. "You have to come into Apple tomorrow morning," he said. "I have a lot of stuff to show you." Horn did, and Jobs hooked him. Steve was so passionate about building this amazing device that would change the world, Horn recalled. "By sheer force of his personality, he changed my mind." Jobs showed Horn exactly how the plastic would be molded and would fit together at perfect angles and how good the board was going to look inside. "He wanted me to see that this whole thing was going to happen, and it was thought out from end to end." "Wow," I said, "I don't see that kind of passion every day." So I signed up. Jobs even tried to re-engage Wozniak. I resented the fact that he had not been doing much, but then I thought, hell, I wouldn't be here without his brilliance, Jobs later told me. But as soon as Jobs was starting to get him interested in the Mac, Wozniak crashed his new single-engine Beechcraft while attempting a takeoff near Santa Cruz. He barely survived and ended up with partial amnesia. Jobs spent time at the hospital, but when Wozniak recovered, he decided it was time to take a break from Apple. 10 years after dropping out of Berkeley, he decided to return there to finally get his degree, enrolling under the name of Rocky Raccoon Clark. In order to make the project his own, Jobs decided it should no longer be codenamed after Raskin's favorite apple. In various interviews, Jobs had been referring to computers as a bicycle for the mind. The ability of humans to create a bicycle allowed them to move more efficiently than even a condor, and likewise the ability to create computers would multiply the efficiency of their minds. So one day Jobs decreed that henceforth the Macintosh should be known instead as the bicycle. This did not go over well. Burl and I thought this was the silliest thing we ever heard, and we simply refused to use the new name, recalled Hertzfeld. Within a month, the idea was dropped. By early 1981, the Mac team had grown to about 20, and Jobs decided that they should have bigger quarters. So he moved everyone to the second floor of a brown shingled two-story building about three blocks from Apple's main offices. It was next to a Texaco station, and thus became known as Texaco Towers. In order to make the office more lively, he told the team to buy a stereo system. Burl and I ran out and bought a silver cassette-based boombox right away, before he could change his mind, recalled Hertzfeld. Jobs' triumph was soon complete. A few weeks after winning his power struggle with Raskin to run the Mac division, he helped push out Mike Scott as Apple's president. Scotty had become more and more erratic, alternately bullying and nurturing. He finally lost most of his support among the employees when he surprised them by imposing a round of layoffs that he handled with atypical ruthlessness. In addition, he had begun to suffer a variety of afflictions, ranging from eye infections to narcolepsy. When Scott was on vacation in Hawaii, Markkula called together the top managers to ask if he should be replaced. Most of them, including Jobs and John Couch, said yes. So Markkula took over as an interim and rather passive president, and Jobs found that he now had full rein to do what he wanted with the Mac division. Chapter 11. The Reality Distortion Field. Playing by his own set of rules. When Andy Hertzfeld joined the Macintosh team, he got a briefing from Bud Tribble, the other software designer, about the huge amount of work that still needed to be done. Jobs wanted it finished by January 1982, less than a year away. "That's crazy," Hertzfeld said. "There's no way." Tribble said that Jobs would not accept any contrary facts. "The best way to describe the situation is a term from Star Trek," Tribble explained. "Steve has a reality distortion field." When Hertzfeld looked puzzled, Tribble elaborated. "In his presence, reality is malleable. He can convince anyone of practically anything. It wears off when he's not around, but it makes it hard to have realistic schedules." Tribble recalled that he adopted the phrase from the Menagerie episodes of Star Trek, in which the aliens create their own new world through sheer mental force. He meant the phrase to be a compliment as well as a caution. It was dangerous to get caught in Steve's distortion field, but it was what led him to actually be able to change reality. At first, Hertzfeld thought that Tribble was exaggerating, but after 2 weeks of working with Jobs, he became a keen observer of the phenomenon. The reality distortion field was a confounding melange of charismatic rhetorical style, indomitable will, an eagerness to bend any fact to fit the purpose at hand, he said. There was little that could shield you from the force, Hertzfeld discovered. Amazingly, the reality distortion field seemed to be effective even if you were acutely aware of it. We would often discuss potential techniques for grounding it, but after a while, most of us gave up, accepting it as a force of nature. After Jobs decreed that the sodas in the office refrigerator be replaced by Odwalla organic orange and carrot juices, someone on the team had T-shirts made. "Reality Distortion Field," they said on the front, and on the back, "It's in the juice." To some people, calling it a reality distortion field was just a clever way to say that Jobs tended to lie. But it was, in fact, a more complex form of dissembling. He would assert something, be it a fact about world history or a recounting of who suggested an idea at a meeting, without even considering the truth. It came from willfully defying reality, not only to others, but to himself. He can deceive himself, said Bill Atkinson. It allowed him to con people into believing his vision, because he has personally embraced and internalized it. A lot of people distort reality, of course. When Jobs did so, it was often a tactic for accomplishing something. Wozniak, who was as congenitally honest as Jobs was tactical, marveled at how effective it could be. His reality distortion is when he has an illogical vision of the future, such as telling me that I could design the breakout game in just a few days. You realize that it can't be true, but he somehow makes it true. When members of the Mac team got ensnared in his reality distortion field, they were almost hypnotized. He reminded me of Rasputin, said Debbie Coleman. He laser beamed in on you and didn't blink. It didn't matter if he was serving purple Kool-Aid, you drank it. But like Wozniak, she believed that the reality distortion field was empowering. It enabled Jobs to inspire his team to change the course of computer history with a fraction of the resources of Xerox or IBM. It was a self-fulfilling distortion, she claimed. You did the impossible because you didn't realize it was impossible. At the root of the reality distortion was Jobs' belief that the rules didn't apply to him. He had some evidence for this. In his childhood, he had often been able to bend reality to his desires. Rebelliousness and willfulness were ingrained into his character. He had the sense that he was special, a chosen one, an enlightened one. He thinks there are a few people who are special, people like Einstein and Gandhi and the gurus he met in India, and he's one of them, said Hertzfeld. He told Chris Ann this. Once he even hinted to me that he was enlightened. It's almost like Nietzsche. Jobs never studied Nietzsche. But the philosopher's concept of the will to power and the special nature of the Uberman came naturally to him. As Nietzsche wrote in Thus Spoke Zarathustra, "The spirit now wills his own will, and he who had been lost to the world now conquers the world." If reality did not comport with his will, he would ignore it, as he had done with the birth of his daughter and would do years later when first diagnosed with cancer. Even in small, everyday rebellions, such as not putting a license plate on his car and parking it in handicapped spaces, he acted as if he were not subject to the strictures around him. Another key aspect of Jobs's worldview was his binary way of categorizing things. People were either enlightened or an asshole. Their work was either the best or totally shitty. Bill Atkinson, the Mac designer who fell on the good side of these dichotomies, described what it was like. It was difficult working under Steve, because there was a great polarity between gods and shitheads. If you were a god, you were up on a pedestal and could do no wrong. Those of us who were considered to be gods, as I was, knew that we were actually mortal and made bad engineering decisions and farted like any person. So we were always afraid that we would get knocked off our pedestal. The ones who were shitheads, who were brilliant engineers working very hard, felt there was no way they could get appreciated and rise above their status. But these categories were not immutable, for Jobs could rapidly reverse himself. When briefing Hertzfeld about the reality distortion field, Tribble specifically warned him about Jobs's tendency to resemble high-voltage alternating current. Just because he tells you that something is awful or great, it doesn't necessarily mean he'll feel that way tomorrow, Tribble explained. If you tell him a new idea, he'll usually tell you that he thinks it's stupid. But then, if he actually likes it, exactly 1 week later, he'll come back to you and propose your idea to you, as if he thought of it. The audacity of this pirouette technique would have dazzled Diaghilev. If one line of argument failed to persuade, he would deftly switch to another, Hertzfeld said. Sometimes he would throw you off balance by suddenly adopting your position as his own, without acknowledging that he ever thought differently. That happened repeatedly to Bruce Horn, the programmer who, with Tesler, had been lured from Xerox PARC. One week I'd tell him about an idea that I had, and he would say it was crazy, recalled Horn. The next week he'd come and say, "Hey, I have this great idea," and it would be my idea. You'd call him on it and say, "Steve, I told you that a week ago," and he'd say, yeah, and just move right along. It was as if Jobs's brain circuits were missing a device that would modulate the extreme spikes of impulsive opinions that popped into his mind. So in dealing with him, the Mac team adopted an audio concept called a low-pass filter. In processing his input, they learned to reduce the amplitude of his high-frequency signals. That served to smooth out the data set and provide a less jittery, moving average of his evolving attitudes. After a few cycles of him taking alternating extreme positions, said Hertzfeld, we would learn to low-pass filter his signals and not react to the extremes. Was Jobs's unfiltered behavior caused by a lack of emotional sensitivity? No, almost the opposite. He was very emotionally attuned, able to read people and know their psychological strengths and vulnerabilities. He could stun an unsuspecting victim with an emotional towel snap, perfectly aimed. He intuitively knew when someone was faking it or truly knew something. This made him masterful at cajoling, stroking, persuading, flattering, and intimidating people. He had the uncanny capacity to know exactly what your weak point is, know what will make you feel small to make you cringe, Joanna Hoffman said. It's a common trait in people who are charismatic and know how to manipulate people. Knowing that he can crush you makes you feel weakened and eager for his approval. So then he can elevate you and put you on a pedestal and own you. Ann Bowers became an expert at dealing with Jobs' perfectionism, petulance, and prickliness. She had been the human resources director at Intel, but had stepped aside after she married its co-founder, Bob Noyce. She joined Apple in 1980 and served as a calming mother figure who would step in after one of Jobs' tantrums. She would go to his office, shut the door, and gently lecture him. I know, he would say. Well then, please stop doing it, she would insist. Bowers recalled, he would be good for a while, and then a week or so later, I would get a call again. She realized that he could barely contain himself. He had these huge expectations, and if people didn't deliver, he couldn't stand it. He couldn't control himself. I could understand why Steve would get upset, and he was usually right, but it had a hurtful effect. It created a fear factor. He was self-aware, but that didn't always modify his behavior. Jobs became close to Bowers and her husband, and he would drop in at their Los Gatos Hills home unannounced. She would hear his motorcycle in the distance and say, "I guess we have Steve for dinner again." For a while, she and Noyce were like a surrogate family. He was so bright and also so needy. He needed a grown-up, a father figure, which Bob became, and I became like a mother figure. There were some upsides to Jobs' demanding and wounding behavior. People who were not crushed ended up being stronger. They did better work out of both fear and an eagerness to please. His behavior can be emotionally draining, but if you survive, it works, Hoffman said. You could also push back sometimes, and not only survive, but thrive. That didn't always work. Raskin tried it, succeeded for a while, and then was destroyed. But if you were calmly confident, if Jobs sized you up and decided that you knew what you were doing, he would respect you. In both his personal and his professional life over the years, his inner circle tended to include many more strong people than toadies. The Mac team knew that. Every year, beginning in 1981, it gave out an award to the person who did the best job of standing up to him. The award was partly a joke, but also partly real, and Jobs knew about it and liked it. Joanna Hoffman won the first year. From an Eastern European refugee family, she had a strong temper and will. One day, for example, she discovered that Jobs had changed her marketing projections in a way she found totally reality-distorting. Furious, she marched to his office. "As I'm climbing the stairs, I told his assistant, 'I am going to take a knife and stab it into his heart,'" she recounted. Al Eisenstadt, the corporate counsel, came running out to restrain her, but Steve heard me out and backed down. Hoffman won the award again in 1982. I remember being envious of Joanna because she would stand up to Steve, and I didn't have the nerve yet, said Debbie Coleman, who joined the Mac team that year. Then in 1983, I got the award. I had learned you had to stand up for what you believed, which Steve respected. I started getting promoted by him after that. Eventually, she rose to become head of manufacturing. One day, Jobs barged into the cubicle of one of Atkinson's engineers and uttered his usual, "This is shit." As Atkinson recalled, the guy said, "No, it's not. It's actually the best way." And he explained to Steve the engineering trade-offs he'd made. Jobs backed down. Atkinson taught his team to put Jobs' words through a translator. We learned to interpret "this is shit" to actually be a question that means, "Tell me why this is the best way to do it." But the story had a coda, which Atkinson also found instructive. Eventually, the engineer found an even better way to perform the function that Jobs had criticized. "He did it better because Steve had challenged him," said Atkinson, "which shows you can push back on him but should also listen, for he's usually right." Jobs' prickly behavior was partly driven by his perfectionism and his impatience with those who made compromises in order to get a product out on time and on budget. "He could not make trade-offs well," said Atkinson. If someone didn't care to make their product perfect, they were a bozo. At the West Coast Computer Fair in April 1981, for example, Adam Osborne released the first truly portable personal computer. It was not great, it had a 5-inch screen and not much memory, but it worked well enough. As Osborne famously declared, "Adequacy is sufficient, all else is superfluous." Jobs found that approach to be morally appalling, and he spent days making fun of Osborne. "This guy just doesn't get it," Jobs repeatedly railed as he wandered the Apple corridors. "He's not making art, he's making shit." One day, Jobs came into the cubicle of Larry Kenyon, an engineer who was working on the Macintosh operating system, and complained that it was taking too long to boot up. Kenyon started to explain, but Jobs cut him off. "If it could save a person's life, would you find a way to shave 10 seconds off the boot time?" he asked. Kenyon allowed that he probably could. Jobs went to a whiteboard and showed that if there were 5 million people using the Mac and it took 10 seconds extra to turn it on every day, that added up to 300 million or so hours per year that people would save, which was the equivalent of at least 100 lifetimes saved per year. Larry was suitably impressed, and a few weeks later he came back, and it booted up 28 seconds faster, Atkinson recalled. Steve had a way of motivating by looking at the bigger picture. The result was that the Macintosh team came to share Jobs' passion for making a great product, not just a profitable one. Jobs thought of himself as an artist, and he encouraged the design team to think of ourselves that way too, said Hertzfeld. The goal was never to beat the competition or to make a lot of money. It was to do the greatest thing possible, or even a little greater. He once took the team to see an exhibit of Tiffany glass at the Metropolitan Museum in Manhattan, because he believed they could learn from Louis Tiffany's example of creating great art that could be mass-produced. Recalled Bud Tribble, "We said to ourselves, hey, if we're going to make things in our lives, we might as well make them beautiful." Was all of his stormy and abusive behavior necessary? Probably not, nor was it justified. There were other ways to have motivated his team. Even though the Macintosh would turn out to be great, it was way behind schedule and way over budget because of Jobs's impetuous interventions. There was also a cost in brutalized human feelings, which caused much of the team to burn out. Steve's contributions could have been made without so many stories about him terrorizing folks, Wozniak said. I like being more patient and not having so many conflicts. I think a company can be a good family. If the Macintosh project had been run my way, things probably would have been a mess. But I think if it had been a mix of both our styles, it would have been better than just the way Steve did it. But even though Jobs' style could be demoralizing, it could also be oddly inspiring. It infused in Apple employees an abiding passion to create groundbreaking products and a belief that they could accomplish what seemed impossible. They had t-shirts made that read, 90 hours a week and loving it. Out of a fear of Jobs mixed with an incredibly strong urge to impress him, they exceeded their own expectations. I've learned over the years that when you have really good people, you don't have to baby them, Jobs later explained. By expecting them to do great things, you can get them to do great things. The original Mac team taught me that A-plus players like to work together, and they don't like it if you tolerate B work. Ask any member of that Mac team. They will tell you it was worth the pain. Most of them agree. He would shout at a meeting, "You asshole, you never do anything right," Debbie Coleman recalled. It was like an hourly occurrence. Yet, I consider myself the absolute luckiest person in the world to have worked with him. Chapter 12. The Design. Real artists simplify. A Bauhaus aesthetic. Unlike most kids who grew up in Eichler homes, Jobs knew what they were and why they were so wonderful. He liked the notion of simple and clean modernism produced for the masses. He also loved listening to his father describe the styling intricacies of various cars. So from the beginning at Apple, he believed that great industrial design, a colorfully simple logo, a sleek case for the Apple II, would set the company apart and make its products distinctive. The company's first office, after it moved out of his family garage, was in a small building it shared with a Sony sales office. Sony was famous for its signature style and memorable product designs, so Jobs would drop by to study the marketing material. He would come in looking scruffy and fondle the product brochures and point out design features, said Daniel Lewin, who worked there. Every now and then he would ask, "Can I take this brochure?" By 1980, he had hired Lewin. His fondness for the dark industrial look of Sony receded around June 1981 when he began attending the annual International Design Conference in Aspen. The meeting that year focused on Italian style, and it featured the architect-designer Mario Bellini, the filmmaker Bernardo Bertolucci, the car maker Sergio Pininfarina, and the Fiat heiress and politician Susanna Agnelli. I had come to revere the Italian designers, just like the kid in Breaking Away reveres the Italian bikers, recalled Jobs, so it was an amazing inspiration. In Aspen, he was exposed to the spare and functional design philosophy of the Bauhaus movement, which was enshrined by Herbert Bayer in the buildings, living suites, sans-serif font typography, and furniture of the Aspen Institute campus. Like his mentors, Walter Gropius and Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, Bayer believed that there should be no distinction between fine art and applied industrial design. The modernist international style championed by the Bauhaus taught that design should be simple, yet have an expressive spirit. It emphasized rationality and functionality by employing clean lines and forms. Among the maxims preached by Mies and Gropius were God is in the details and less is more. As with Eichler Holmes, the artistic sensibility was combined with a capability for mass production. Jobs publicly discussed his embrace of the Bauhaus style in a talk he gave at the 1983 Design Conference, the theme of which was, "The future isn't what it used to be." He predicted the passing of the Sony style in favor of Bauhaus simplicity. "The current wave of industrial design is Sony's high-tech look, which is gunmetal gray, maybe painted black, do weird stuff to it," he said. "It's easy to do that, but it's not great." He proposed an alternative, born of the Bauhaus, that was more true to the function and nature of the products. "What we're going to do is make the products high-tech, and we're going to package them cleanly, so that you know they're high-tech. We will fit them in a small package, and then we can make them beautiful and white, just like Braun does with its electronics." He repeatedly emphasized that Apple's products would be clean and simple. "We will make them bright and pure and honest about being high-tech, rather than a heavy industrial look of black, 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 like Sony," he preached. "So that's our approach. Very simple. And we're really shooting for Museum of Modern Art quality. The way we're running the company, the product design, the advertising, it all comes down to this. Let's make it simple. Really simple." Apple's design mantra would remain the one featured on its first brochure. Simplicity is the ultimate sophistication. Jobs felt that design simplicity should be linked to making products easy to use. Those goals do not always go together. Sometimes a design can be so sleek and simple that a user finds it intimidating or unfriendly to navigate. "The main thing in our design is that we have to make things intuitively obvious," Jobs told the crowd of design mavens. For example, he extolled the desktop metaphor he was creating for the Macintosh. "People know how to deal with a desktop intuitively. If you walk into an office, there are papers on the desk. The one on the top is the most important. People know how to switch priority. Part of the reason we model our computers on metaphors like the desktop is that we can leverage this experience people already have." Speaking at the same time as Jobs that Wednesday afternoon, but in a smaller seminar room, was Maya Lin, 23, who had been catapulted into fame the previous November when her Vietnam Veterans Memorial was dedicated in Washington, D.C. They struck up a close friendship, and Jobs invited her to visit Apple. "I came to work with Steve for a week," Lin recalled. "I asked him, why do computers look like clunky TV sets? Why don't you make something thin? Why not a flat laptop?" Jobs replied that this was indeed his goal as soon as the technology was ready. At that time, there was not much exciting happening in the realm of industrial design, Jobs felt. He had a Richard Sapper lamp, which he admired, and he also liked the furniture of Charles and Ray Eames and the Braun products of Dieter Rams. But there were no towering figures energizing the world of industrial design the way that Raymond Loewy and Herbert Bayer had done. There really wasn't much going on in industrial design, particularly in Silicon Valley. "And Steve was very eager to change that," said Lin. "His design sensibility is sleek but not slick, and it's playful. He embraced minimalism, which came from his Zen devotion to simplicity, but he avoided allowing that to make his products cold. They stayed fun. He's passionate and super serious about design, but at the same time, there's a sense of play." As Jobs' design sensibilities evolved, he became particularly attracted to the Japanese style and began hanging out with its stars, such as Issey Miyake and I.M. Pei. His Buddhist training was a big influence. "I have always found Buddhism, Japanese Zen Buddhism in particular, to be aesthetically sublime," he said. "The most sublime thing I've ever seen are the gardens around Kyoto. I'm deeply moved by what that culture has produced, and it's directly from Zen Buddhism. Like a Porsche. Jeff Raskin's vision for the Macintosh was that it would be like a boxy carry-on suitcase, which would be closed by flipping up the keyboard over the front screen. When Jobs took over the project, he decided to sacrifice portability for a distinctive design that wouldn't take up much space on a desk. He plopped down a phone book and declared, to the horror of the engineers, that it shouldn't have a footprint larger than that. So his design team of Jerry Manek and Terry Oyama began working on ideas that had the screen above the computer box with a keyboard that was detachable. One day in March 1981, Andy Hertzfeld came back to the office from dinner to find Jobs hovering over their one Mac prototype in intense discussion with the creative services director, James Ferris. "We need it to have a classic look that won't go out of style, like the Volkswagen Beetle," Jobs said. From his father, he had developed an appreciation for the contours of classic cars. "No, that's not right," Ferris replied. "The line should be voluptuous, like a Ferrari." "Not a Ferrari. That's not right either," Jobs countered. "It should be more like a Porsche." Jobs owned a Porsche 928 at the time. When Bill Atkinson was over one weekend, Jobs brought him outside to admire the car. "Great art stretches the taste. It doesn't follow tastes," he told Atkinson. He also admired the design of the Mercedes. "Over the years, they've made the lines softer, but the details starker," he said one day as he walked around the parking lot. "That's what we have to do with the Macintosh." Oyama drafted a preliminary design and had a plaster model made. The Mac team gathered around for the unveiling and expressed their thoughts. Hertzfeld called it cute. Others also seemed satisfied. Then Jobs let loose a blistering burst of criticism. "It's way too boxy. It's got to be more curvaceous. The radius of the first chamfer needs to be bigger, and I don't like the size of the bevel." With his new fluency in industrial design lingo, Jobs was referring to the angular or curved edge connecting the sides of the computer. But then he gave a resounding compliment. "It's a start," he said. Every month or so, Manek and Oyama would present a new iteration based on Jobs's previous criticisms. The latest plaster model would be dramatically unveiled, and all the previous attempts would be lined up next to it. That not only helped them gauge the design's evolution, but it prevented Jobs from insisting that one of his suggestions had been ignored. "By the fourth model, I could barely distinguish it from the third one," said Hertzfeld. But Steve was always critical and decisive, saying he loved or hated a detail that I could barely perceive. One weekend, Jobs went to Macy's in Palo Alto and again spent time studying appliances, especially the Cuisinart. He came bounding into the Mac office that Monday, asked the design team to go buy one, and made a raft of new suggestions based on its lines, curves, and bevels. Jobs kept insisting that the machine should look friendly. As a result, it evolved to resemble a human face. With the disk drive built in below the screen, the unit was taller and narrower than most computers, suggesting a head. The recess near the base evoked a gentle chin, and Jobs narrowed the strip of plastic at the top so that it avoided the Neanderthal forehead that made the Lisa subtly unattractive. The patent for the design of the Apple case was issued in the name of Steve Jobs as well as Manek and Oyama. Even though Steve didn't draw any of the lines, his ideas and inspiration made the design what it is, Oyama later said. "To be honest, we didn't know what it meant for a computer to be friendly until Steve told us." Jobs obsessed with equal intensity about the look of what would appear on the screen. One day, Bill Atkinson burst into Texaco Towers all excited. He had just come up with a brilliant algorithm that could draw circles and ovals on screen quickly. The math for making circles usually required calculating square roots. which the 68,000 microprocessor didn't support. But Atkinson did a workaround based on the fact that the sum of a sequence of odd numbers produces a sequence of perfect squares. For example, 1 plus 3 equals 4, 1 plus 3 plus 5 equals 9, etc. Hertzfeld recalled that when Atkinson fired up his demo, everyone was impressed except Jobs. "Well, circles and ovals are good," he said. "But how about drawing rectangles with rounded corners?" "I don't think we really need it," said Atkinson, who explained that it would be almost impossible to do. "I wanted to keep the graphics routines lean and limit them to the primitives that truly needed to be done," he recalled. "Rectangles with rounded corners are everywhere," Jobs said, jumping up and getting more intense. "Just look around this room." He pointed out the whiteboard and the tabletop and other objects that were rectangular with rounded corners. "And look outside. There's even more, practically everywhere you look." He dragged Atkinson out for a walk, pointing out car windows and billboards and street signs. "Within 3 blocks, we found 17 examples," said Jobs. "I started pointing them out everywhere until he was completely convinced. When he finally got to a no parking sign, I said, 'Okay, you're right, I give up. We need to have a rounded corner rectangle as a primitive.'" Hertzfeld recalled, "Bill returned to Texaco Towers the following afternoon with a big smile on his face. His demo was now drawing rectangles with beautifully rounded corners blisteringly fast. The dialog boxes and windows on the Lisa and the Mac and almost every other subsequent computer ended up being rendered with rounded corners. At the calligraphy class he had audited at Reed, Jobs learned to love typefaces with all of their serif and sans-serif variations, proportional spacing, and leading. "When we were designing the first Macintosh computer, it all came back to me," he later said of that class. Because the Mac was bitmapped, it was possible to devise an endless array of fonts, ranging from the elegant to the wacky, and render them pixel by pixel on the screen. To design these fonts, Hertzfeld recruited a high school friend from suburban Philadelphia, Susan Kerr. They named the fonts after the stops on Philadelphia's mainline commuter train: Overbrook, Marion, Ardmore, and Rosemont. Jobs found the process fascinating. Late one afternoon, he stopped by and started brooding about the font names. "They were little cities that nobody's ever heard of," he complained. "They ought to be world-class cities." The fonts were renamed Chicago, New York, Geneva, London, San Francisco, Toronto, and Venice. Markala and some others could never quite appreciate Jobs's obsession with typography. His knowledge of fonts was remarkable, and he kept insisting on having great ones, Markala recalled. "I kept saying, 'Fonts? Don't we have more important things to do?'" In fact, the delightful assortment of Macintosh fonts, when combined with laser writer printing and great graphics capabilities, would help launch the desktop publishing industry and be a boon for Apple's bottom line. It also introduced all sorts of regular folks, ranging from high school journalists to moms who edited PTA newsletters, to the quirky joy of knowing about fonts, which was once reserved for printers, grizzled editors, and other ink-stained wretches. Kerr also developed the icons, such as the trash can for discarding files, that helped define graphical interfaces. She and Jobs hit it off because they shared an instinct for simplicity along with a desire to make the Mac whimsical. "He usually came in at the end of every day," she said. "He'd always want to know what was new, and he's always had good taste and a good sense for visual details. Sometimes he came in on Sunday morning, so Kerr made it a point to be there working. Every now and then, she would run into a problem. He rejected one of her renderings of a rabbit, an icon for speeding up the mouse click rate, saying that the furry creature looked too gay." Jobs lavished similar attention on the title bars atop windows and documents. He had Atkinson and Kerr do them over and over again as he agonized over their look. He did not like the ones on the Lisa because they were too black and harsh. He wanted the ones on the Mac to be smoother, to have pinstripes. We must have gone through 20 different title bar designs before he was happy, Atkinson recalled. At one point, Karen Atkinson complained that he was making them spend too much time on tiny little tweaks to the title bar when they had bigger things to do. Jobs erupted. "Can you imagine looking at that every day?" he shouted. "It's not just a little thing. It's something we have to do right." Chris Espinoza found one way to satisfy Jobs' design demands and control freak tendencies. One of Wozniak's youthful acolytes from the days in the garage, Espinoza had been convinced to drop out of Berkeley by Jobs, who argued that he would always have a chance to study, but only one chance to work on the Mac. On his own, he decided to design a calculator for the computer. We all gathered around as Chris showed the calculator to Steve and then held his breath, waiting for Steve's reaction, Hertzfeldt recalled. "Well, it's a start," Jobs said, "but basically, it stinks. The background color is too dark, some lines are the wrong thickness, and the buttons are too big." Espinoza kept refining it in response to Jobs' critiques day after day, but with each iteration came new criticisms. So finally, one afternoon, when Jobs came by, Espinoza unveiled his inspired solution, the Steve Jobs Roll Your Own Calculator Construction Set. It allowed the user to tweak and personalize the look of the calculator by changing the thickness of the lines, the size of the buttons, the shading, the background, and other attributes. Instead of just laughing, Jobs plunged in and started to play around with the look to suit his tastes. After about 10 minutes, he got it the way he liked. His design, not surprisingly, was the one that shipped on the Mac and remained the standard for 15 years. Although his focus was on the Macintosh, Jobs wanted to create a consistent design language for all Apple products. So he set up a contest to choose a world-class designer who would be for Apple what Dieter Rams was for Braun. The project was codenamed Snow White, not because of his preference for the color, but because the products to be designed were codenamed after the Seven Dwarfs. The winner was Hartmut Esslinger, a German designer who was responsible for the look of Sony's Trinitron televisions. Jobs flew to the Black Forest region of Bavaria to meet him, and he was impressed not only with Esslinger's passion, but also his spirited way of driving his Mercedes at more than 100 miles per hour. Even though he was German, Esslinger proposed that there should be a born-in-America gene for Apple's DNA that would produce a California global look, inspired by Hollywood and music, a bit of rebellion, and natural sex appeal. His guiding principle was form follows emotion, a play on the familiar maxim that form follows function. He produced 40 models of products to demonstrate the concept, and when Jobs saw them, he proclaimed, "Yes, this is it." The Snow White look, which was adopted immediately for the Apple IIc, featured white cases, tight rounded curves, and lines of thin grooves for both ventilation and decoration. Jobs offered Esslinger a contract on the condition that he move to California. They shook hands, and in Esslinger's not-so-modest words, that handshake launched one of the most decisive collaborations in the history of industrial design. Esslinger's firm, Frog Design, opened in Palo Alto in mid-1983, with a $1.2 million annual contract to work for Apple, and from then on, every Apple product has included the proud declaration, "Designed in California." From his father, Jobs had learned that a hallmark of passionate craftsmanship is making sure that even the aspects that will remain hidden are done beautifully. One of the most extreme and telling implementations of that philosophy came when he scrutinized the printed circuit board that would hold the chips and other components deep inside the Macintosh. No consumer would ever see it, but Jobs began critiquing it on aesthetic grounds. That part's really pretty, he said. But look at the memory chips. That's ugly. The lines are too close together. One of the new engineers interrupted and asked why it mattered. The only thing that's important is how well it works. Nobody is going to see the PC board. Jobs reacted typically. I want it to be as beautiful as possible, even if it's inside the box. A great carpenter isn't going to use lousy wood for the back of a cabinet, even though nobody's going to see it. In an interview a few years later, after the Macintosh came out, Jobs again reiterated that lesson from his father. When you're a carpenter making a beautiful chest of drawers, you're not going to use a piece of plywood on the back, even though it faces the wall and nobody will ever see it. You'll know it's there, so you're going to use a beautiful piece of wood on the back. For you to sleep well at night, the aesthetic, the quality, has to be carried all the way through. From Mike Markala, he had learned the importance of packaging and presentation. People do judge a book by its cover, so for the box of the Macintosh, Jobs chose a full-color design and kept trying to make it look better. He got the guys to redo it 50 times, recalled Alan Rossman, a member of the Mac team who married Joanna Hoffman. It was going to be thrown in the trash as soon as the consumer opened it, but he was obsessed by how it looked. To Rossman, this showed a lack of balance. Money was being spent on expensive packaging while they were trying to save money on the memory chips. But for Jobs, each detail was essential to making the Macintosh amazing. When the design was finally locked in, Jobs called the Macintosh team together for a ceremony. Real artists sign their work, he said. So he got out a sheet of drafting paper and a Sharpie pen and had all of them sign their names. The signatures were engraved inside each Macintosh. No one would ever see them, but the members of the team knew that their signatures were inside, just as they knew that the circuit board was laid out as elegantly as possible. Jobs called them each up by name, one at a time. Burl Smith went first. Jobs waited until last, after all 45 of the others. He found a place right in the center of the sheet and signed his name in lowercase letters with a grand flair. Then he toasted them with champagne. With moments like this, he got us seeing our work as art, said Atkinson. Chapter 13. Building the Mac. The journey is the reward. Competition. When IBM introduced its personal computer in August 1981, Jobs had his team buy one and dissect it. Their consensus was that it sucked. Chris Espinoza called it a half-assed, hackneyed attempt, and there was some truth to that. It used old-fashioned command-line prompts and didn't support bitmapped graphical displays. Apple became cocky, not realizing that corporate technology managers might feel more comfortable buying from an established company like IBM rather than one named after a piece of fruit. Bill Gates happened to be visiting Apple headquarters for a meeting on the day the IBM PC was announced. They didn't seem to care, he said. It took them a year to realize what had happened. Reflecting its cheeky confidence, Apple took out a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal with the headline, "Welcome, IBM." Seriously. It cleverly positioned the upcoming computer battle as a two-way contest between the spunky and rebellious Apple and the establishment Goliath IBM, conveniently relegating to irrelevance companies such as Commodore, Tandy, and Osborne that were doing just as well as Apple. Throughout his career, Jobs liked to see himself as an enlightened rebel pitted against evil empires, a Jedi warrior or Buddhist samurai fighting the forces of darkness. IBM was his perfect foil. He cleverly cast the upcoming battle not as a mere business competition, but as a spiritual struggle. If for some reason we make some giant mistakes and IBM wins, my personal feeling is that we are going to enter sort of a computer dark ages for about 20 years, he told an interviewer. Once IBM gains control of a market sector, they almost always stop innovation. Even 30 years later, reflecting back on the competition, Jobs cast it as a holy crusade. IBM was essentially Microsoft at its worst. They were not a force for innovation, they were a force for evil. They were like AT&T or Microsoft or Google is. Unfortunately for Apple, Jobs also took aim at another perceived competitor to his Macintosh, the company's own Lisa. Partly it was psychological. He had been ousted from that group, and now he wanted to beat it. He also saw healthy rivalry as a way to motivate his troops. That's why he bet John Couch $5,000 that the Mac would ship before the Lisa. The problem was that the rivalry became unhealthy. Jobs repeatedly portrayed his band of engineers as the cool kids on the block, in contrast to the plotting HP engineer types working on the Lisa. More substantively, when he moved away from Jeff Raskin's plan for an inexpensive and underpowered portable appliance and reconceived the Mac as a desktop machine with a graphical user interface, it became a scaled-down version of the Lisa that would likely undercut it in the marketplace. Larry Tesler, who managed application software for the Lisa, realized that it would be important to design both machines to use many of the same software programs. So to broker peace, he arranged for Smith and Hertzfeld to come to the Lisa workspace and demonstrate the Mac prototype. 25 engineers showed up and were listening politely when halfway into the presentation, the door burst open. It was Rich Page, a volatile engineer who was responsible for much of the Lisa's design. "The Macintosh is going to destroy the Lisa," he shouted. "The Macintosh is going to ruin Apple." Neither Smith nor Hertzfeld responded, so Page continued his rant. "Jobs wants to destroy Lisa because we wouldn't let him control it," he said, looking as if he were about to cry. "Nobody's going to buy a Lisa because they know the Mac is coming, but you don't care." He stormed out of the room and slammed the door, but a moment later he barged back in briefly. "I know it's not your fault," he said to Smith and Hertzfeld. "Steve Jobs is the problem. Tell Steve that he's destroying Apple." Jobs did indeed make the Macintosh into a low-cost competitor to the Lisa, one with incompatible software. Making matters worse was that neither machine was compatible with the Apple II. With no one in overall charge at Apple, there was no chance of keeping Jobs in harness. End-to-end control. Jobs's reluctance to make the Mac compatible with the architecture of the Lisa was motivated by more than rivalry or revenge. There was a philosophical component, one that was related to his penchant for control. He believed that for a computer to be truly great, its hardware and its software had to be tightly linked. When a computer was open to running software that also worked on other computers, it would end up sacrificing some functionality. The best products, he believed, were whole widgets that were designed end-to-end, with the software closely tailored to the hardware and vice versa. This is what would distinguish the Macintosh, which had an operating system that worked only on its own hardware, from the environment that Microsoft was creating, in which its operating system could be used on hardware made by many different companies. Jobs is a strong-willed, elitist artist who doesn't want his creations mutated inauspiciously by unworthy programmers, explained ZDNet's editor Dan Farber. "It would be as if someone off the street added some brushstrokes to a Picasso painting, or changed the lyrics to a Dylan song." In later years, Jobs's whole widget approach would distinguish the iPhone, iPod, and iPad from their competitors. It resulted in awesome products, but it was not always the best strategy for dominating a market. From the first Mac to the latest iPhone, Jobs's systems have always been sealed shut to prevent consumers from meddling and modifying them. noted Leander Caney, author of Cult of the Mac. Jobs's desire to control the user experience had been at the heart of his debate with Wozniak over whether the Apple II would have slots that allow